Welcome to the Citizens for Health radio show on Building Fortunes Radio with your hosts, Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Make sure you check us out by clicking on the Citizens for Health radio show link on buildingfortunesradio.com. That's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Citizens for Health provides over 100,000 supporters with consumer news, action alerts, and opportunities to take action. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. The Citizens for Health Education Foundation offers tools to inform the public of health issues and educate and influence policymakers. Jim Turner is here to spread the word about some of the most interesting topics that can affect your world, from the dangers of mislabeled or dangerous products to the questions and concerns of vaccines. You'll want to listen to Jim as he speaks on behalf of Citizens for Health. And now, on to our show with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Take it away, Peter.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. For all those people that might be unfamiliar with my voice, my name is Peter Mingles. We host this radio show with Jim Turner every Friday when we can at noon p.m. Eastern time. And Jim is in the car right now. You'll hear from some of the background noise, so we'll kind of handle that right away. We're going to kind of keep it a little bit short and concise on this radio show because we want to focus on driving and all that sort of cool stuff. But there's a lot of topics that we can talk about today. But one of the most important things I want to do is I want to give you Jim's background, and I'll let him talk to a little bit about his background as well. But he's been with us for a really long time on Building Fortunes Radio. We have buildingfortunesradio.com/citizens. If you go to citizens.org, that's CITIZENS.ORG, you'll be able to sign up for the newsletter and see the cool things that he does. And he's been working with an organization called Citizens for Health, which has been a great organization since 1993, has been helping to do a whole bunch of really cool stuff. We've spoken about everything from mercury fillings to homeopathy to vaccinations, of course, to politics, to stuff that's going on in social media, to stuff that's going on in the law, and stuff that's happening in home-based businesses. And Jim's been around a really long time, has a huge amount of knowledge, and I respect his opinion completely. And many times he's helped to actually frame some of the things that we've spoken about or done personally, even in my life, everything from, you know, replacing my electric meter back to a digital meter, not from a digital meter to an analog meter, to worrying about EMF and 5G and a few other things as well, and not in a conspiracy kind of a way. We're just talking about real solid stuff. So I'm going to kind of get out of the way, let Jim introduce himself quickly, and then we're going to talk about a couple of different topics. One of the ones I kind of picked for today was, of course, what's going on January 20th in the inauguration. Another one we're going to squeeze in is going to be what's happening with Donald Trump and conservatives and other people that are being censored. And then the last one is going to be what's happening with vaccines. So, Jim Turner, you can tell us about you and then pick your topic.
Okay, well, Peter, it's glad to be here. I always enjoy these Friday noontime conversations. I think we've touched on a lot of very good topics, and there is a good archive, which is on the Citizens for Health website as well as yours. And actually, we're getting increasing number of responses back with people commenting and asking things. So we look for that and encourage that. You can do that on our Citizens page and on your page as well. Let me give you a quick thumbnail background to fill in some of the things that you said. I started out when I was 10 years old saying I want to be a lawyer. And the idea was that in this society, lawyers have a way of getting at questions and the courts and so forth to resolve conflicts and move policies forward and choices and help people be able to be better off. I mean, that's the basic premise. And that's what I wanted to do. I ended up going to Ohio State Law School after spending 4 years in the Navy as a naval officer. I'd been going to undergraduate school on a naval ROTC scholarship and stayed in the reserves for 3 years after that. Spent a lot of time, studied international law as a part of that and a whole range of things. And then I ran into Ralph Nader and Unsafe at Any Speed, and I found that there was a very good critique of what was going on in the country in the 1960s. That continues down to the very day today, and that is that a substantial amount of the decisions that we need to make in our society are being made by concentrated economic interest, mainly corporations, but there are some others, very, very large philanthropic institutions and individuals. There are nonprofit organizations that have enormous economic power. And so the concentration of the economic power in narrow hands caused decisions to be made more in the direction of the interests of the concentrated economic powers. That was the issue that came up. I worked out a whole range of things. Started out with food, and we worked hard to get Organic Food Production Act through Congress, and that was in 1990. We got, as far as health went, we got acupuncture needles approved or recognized by FDA in 1996. And when I say we have teams of all of these folks, of which I was a part, and you know, we were the lawyers for and did a lot of work of that kind. We've worked very, very hard on the entire idea of right to choice in healthcare so that individuals can make choices that will advance their own personal health. Our belief is that individuals making informed choices are the best way for a society to make societal choices. They'll accumulate. It gets called in the parlance of the world, the market. But as individuals go out and make choices and they say, this is what's best for my health and this is what I'm going to do, and there's a wide range of choices, they will gradually, through that marketplace, work toward a very good decision for the whole society. Unfortunately, what's happened is those large concentrated economic interests that I talked about have twisted the market so that it just no longer responds to or reflects what the consumer's choices are. Rather, it reflects what the manufacturers and merchants want to have. This, by the way, is a very interesting concept because it was Adam Smith who pointed it out back in 1776, wrote The Wealth of Nations. And in the second edition of Wealth of Nations in 1883, he said, consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production, and the producer's interest ought to be attended to only insofar as it advances that of the consumer. That's the premise I began working with in the Nader organization and has continued with all of the things I've been doing. Adam Smith went on to say that the laws of that time, mercantilism, as they called it at that time, mercantilism, were designed in such a way that they did not advance the consumer interest or the consumption interest, they advanced the production interest. And then Adam Smith said, who could have made these laws to be this way? Well, the merchants and manufacturers. That's who we need to deal with, the merchants and the manufacturers. And that's a very serious, fundamental, philosophical, empirical, experiential point. The point is that concentrated economic power in the hands of merchants and manufacturers tends to twist the market away from the things that consumers want to have for their own well-being. And that means that the entire ability of society to make its choices is undermined. That's a very serious problem that we need to address, and that's what we've been doing. And just one final tie to this introduction to what we're talking about is the fact that that over the years, since 1970, when I wrote the book The Chemical Feast, the Nader Report on the Food and Drug Administration, there have been major marketplace activities that have been fueled by enlightened or aware consumers. In 1969, the dietary supplement marketplace median age of customers went down 10 years. That is, a whole massive new group of consumers went into the dietary supplement marketplace. And they evolved into what's called now the natural food marketplace, which evolved into things like Whole Foods, which has now evolved into something as a subsidiary of Amazon. What I'm saying is these impulses, that's the consumer impulse to advance health through nutrition, has consistently moved along for the last 60 years or so. The same thing is true about alternative health, or what we call now integrative health. Right now, the AMA, which dominated medicine up until the post-Second World War period and pretty much into the 60s, that agency, that organization, of all of the MDs in the United States, only about 10% belong to the AMA. It still has enormous power because it controls the billing codes for how you bill for reimbursement from Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies. It has enormous income from drug advertising and its magazines, and it owns quite a bit of real estate. Now, you put all of this together, and you end up with a very, very powerful concentrated economic institution, which really does not reflect either the market in general or the individual consumer's choices. Now, frankly, we're having a lot of trouble with COVID because of that, because we have a very narrow way of looking at the COVID question. The COVID question is looked at through what can the large concentrated corporations working in hand with government create for individuals to be able to solve the problem of COVID. Now, that's a very valuable, positive way of thinking about it from their point of view. The big problem is that they squeeze out all other points of view. The metaphor I like to use, you probably heard it on this program before, is that, you know, science and those concentrated power centers and so forth basically are like taking a flashlight into the attic of a house. You know, and you shine the flashlight on the old dress and the flag and the stuffed owl and so forth, and you can say definitely, hey, there's a flag, there's an old dress, there's a stuffed owl. All very positive, very good. We're doing that with COVID. We can see this, we can see that, we can see the other. The big mistake that's made by the rationalist, scientific, concentrated economic power center is to then go on and say, and there is nothing else in this attic. Furthermore, there are no other attics. Now, both of those things really limit the ability of the individual to make choices for themselves, and therefore limit the ability of government and markets working together, as opposed to government and corporations working together, to come up with the best decisions for society. So that's kind of the dynamic that all of this stuff comes out of. And we have some organizations that we've worked on over the years. I did the Chemical Feast and published that in 1970, then created the law firm Swanken & Turner in 72 to carry on that activity. 77, we created the National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy, which is currently involved very, very deeply in the whole issue of EMF, the whole question of complementary and alternative medical approaches to deal with things like the COVID and then EMF. One of the interesting problems is that there are a lot of things that undermine the immune system. And we need to strengthen the immune system. And many of the integrative medicine approaches are very, very good for improving the immune system, including acupuncture, for example. And they are not generally being used in our current framework in a meaningful way, because the FDA and the FTC and the various regulators and the vaccine groups and so forth, the vaccine government groups, are all out there pushing so hard for the scientific vaccine approach that they are systematically undermining every other possible approach. And I think that's a serious error. That's the kind of framework within which we work. We've been talking, I think, on this program since about 2014. And there are many, many issues, all of which fall into this framework. And we can go on today and talk about whatever things, Peter, you think would be useful to talk about. That gives kind of a context for where we are.
Yeah, no, that's great information. So for those people listening in, you could share all of these radio shows. If you go to buildingfortressradio.com, /citizens, you'll be able to find these radio shows and listen to any one of them, and you'll be able to share this with people in your organization. They'll get a lot smarter, a lot more educated, and have a better approach towards handling the different things that we're running across. So I'm going to pick up what you said about the merchants and the manufacturers a little bit earlier in the 1700s and 1800s. Then kind of switch it over to just a little bit of more of a technical, if you will, merchant or manufacturer. And let's move on to the social media sites, because they really do produce a product. It may not be a physical product, but it's a product, so they're producing something. So maybe they're like the merchants and the manufacturers, and they are determining the rules. And we're watching that as it's happening. So can you talk to us a little bit about that relative to what your insight is on that politically, as well as, you know, anything else as far as a cultural thing?
Well, how does information flow in a society? That's one of the most crucial questions. So I was just listening before I got on this program to the 1A program on public radio, in which they were talking about how China's handling the COVID issue. And the Chinese argument is, using COVID, we've got a terrible COVID situation in the U.S., comparatively speaking. Excuse my noise here for just a moment. We have a terrible problem in, let's just give you an example on China. They have a city, according to the news this morning, of 22 million people that is completely locked down. That is 100% of 22 million people need to remain in their homes because four cases of COVID turned up in that city.
Four?
The borders to the city.
You said four.
Yeah, one, two, three, four. We're having 4,000 a day of cases. I think that's 4,000 a day deaths in this country. And there was four cases. That wasn't four deaths, I don't believe. I think it was four cases. But in any case, the Chinese believe that they've got a really good operation going because they can close off their city. They've got cops at every corner. You can't go out of your house and so forth, according to the news. And they also, at the same time, 100% control their social media. There's not a single social media thing that goes out if the Chinese government wants it to not go out. They're pointing to the United States. They're saying, see, the U.S. is the same. They just got these people that they just closed off the president. They've closed off a bunch of other people. It's just the same as China. It's no different. Now, the interesting question is, what does it mean? Is it a good thing that it's just the same as China, or is it a bad thing? Well, from the Chinese point of view, they're saying, in their own philosophical way, it's a good thing, except that it should be the government doing it, not the corporations. So in hops the Germans and a bunch of other Europeans who are saying, well, we don't think it's good to have these concentrated corporations cutting off the president of the United States. We think there should be rules in the government that make that decision. Now, where do they stand? Are they standing with the Chinese, or the government should close it off, or are they standing with the Americans that are saying, let's let the corporations close it off? Well, they're standing out there not knowing where to stand. And my suggestion is, and we have a group that I'm involved with very closely, a co-founder of, called the Transpartisan Review, and we're working on transpartisan politics, which has lots of manifestations in the current political situation, to say that you can't look at this as an either or. There are a multiplicity of all options. So what we may need to do, I'll jolt you with something that I think about quite frequently. What would happen if we had a situation where the president of Google, Twitter, Amazon, what if they had to be elected by the customers of those institutions? What if every time you did you took an action on Amazon, you were able to vote who should be running Amazon, or Twitter, or Apple, or Google, or Facebook? What if Mark Zuckerberg had to run for re-election every 4 years? Now, I'm not arguing that that's a good idea. I'm arguing that you need to see the difference between the two ideas. There's an argument that we have a battle going on between socialism and capitalism in this country. I actually think the battle that we have going on one hand, is between free market capitalism and mercantile capitalism on the one hand. On the other hand, we have administrative state government versus free state government going on. And so you've got actually what we call in the Transpartisan Review a matrix where you've got actually four different components on every issue. And I'm saying within regard to the closing off of the president from Facebook or Twitter, that's a very interesting issue. Do we know that the Facebook on Twitter is important in fomenting the violence that went on in the Capitol? Do we know that? Well, it's hard to know. There's been lots of arguments in court about the issue of whether the election was stolen or not. So far, there's not been any court that's found that there was evidence that it did. How do we sort something out like that, where a whole bunch of people feel that something happened and a whole bunch of other people feel it didn't, and the courts are asked to resolve it, and the courts resolve it in the best way the courts know how, and then the people who didn't like the resolution say, well, let's go tear down the Capitol. In that context, it's important to understand that the numbers are very, very significant. At most, from every data that I can see, at most, about 20% of the electorate says that they have some doubts about the election. About 20%. Now, the way we're structured through gerrymandering and voter absence, a lot of voters don't register. Many of them just don't want to vote. Lots of people don't participate in our electoral process. A lot of them believe it's been fixed for a long time on both sides, Democrats and Republicans. So you have 20% of the public now who is expressing doubts about the election. And that 20% is being engaged with by the president. And the president is arguing, we got to do something about this because it's wrong to deny the rights of 20%. You have to be careful about that kind of an argument, because if you go too far, you're denying the rights of 80%. So let's go back and say, what should the president do? Well, what would have been a lot better if he had said something along the lines of, I'm going over to the Capitol, as he did. I said, follow me to the Capitol. If he had gone and been in charge of that crowd and led a nonviolent presentation. Look, we're unhappy. We're 20% of the electorate. We don't feel things are fair. We would like this to be looked at. And that could have been a very useful, effective, right, legal thing to do. Unfortunately, that isn't what the president chose to do and what the people that followed him chose to do. So we ended up with a situation which is in many, many ways very dangerous. Because we don't know who makes the decision in this point. And we'll see. It'll sort itself out. It's, you know, it's working its way along, and we'll see what happens. But my point very simply is that trying to argue for or against whether Twitter should or shouldn't get rid of the president's account is a narrow way of looking at the issue. The question is, how do we manage the flow of information? And most every regulatory agency is designed to do that. And frankly, from my point of view, as I wrote in the Chemical Feast about the FDA, I think they do a lousy job of it, because basically they cut off the voice of the consumer almost completely. So that's my answer on how I see the president's being handled.
So
he's not being handled well. He's not being handled
right.
Well, but a lot of it is his fault, or you know, his problem. He didn't play the cards very well.
Okay, so a separate question, and we only have a few minutes left because I know you're driving. We said we're going to keep this down to 30 minutes. In relationship to the decisions that these companies are making to shut him off all at once, I know individually, I'm sure, none of these spokespeople for these companies like Jack Dorsey or Mark Zuckerberg work on their own. They probably don't do many things without their attorney's consent one way or another. I'm imagining at their level, with this level of experience, they're not making rookie mistakes. So is it going to be possible for anybody to fight these things in court, like what they did with Parler? Now, for those people that – most of our listening audience is familiar with Parler, so I won't explain it. But Parler, spelled P-A-R-L-E-R, was an alternative for Twitter. And literally, every component of Parler shut Parler down, from the hosting – to the place where you go download the app, to lots of different places as well. So what is your opinion of that? Because they wiped Parler out, and they probably hurt the shareholders of all the people that were invested in Parler, because it was a privately held company, probably valued probably close to going to $1 billion by the time we were finished with 2021. So what's your opinion, maybe like somewhat of a, not a legal opinion, but some kind of an opinion on, can they do that, or is that possible, or why did they do that?
Yeah. Well, let me just say that the likelihood is that yes, they can. They are going to challenge it legally. I'm not clear that there's any real legal argument that can allow them to win. There are some large arguments that might be credibly made, but I want to again say you've got to look at the playing field that we're involved in here. It wasn't only they got rid of Parler, but remember that the National Association of Manufacturers, large group of concentrated economic interests, were the first to call for use of the 25th Amendment to get rid of Trump. Very shortly thereafter, you know, these companies cut off Trump's accounts, and then the Chamber of Commerce said, and a bunch of other companies individually said, we're not going to put campaign contributions into any of the candidates that were voting for against impeaching Trump, basically arguing that we're not going to put money into any campaign of anybody who said the election was fixed. Now,
right.
It's hard for me to believe that there isn't at least a shared view of reality by the major manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, the merchants, Twitter and so forth are the communicating sector, and that set is operating at least out of a shared set of values. And that shared set of values is very, very, very nervous when the public starts to act. Now, Martin Luther King, when he walked across the Pettus Bridge, was in a very interesting situation. The first thing he did was to start a march, which he then stopped because there was a court order against it. So he did not go forward on that march. He went back and they took a march later, separately. And he chose not to violate a court order. Now, the point is that there are tools and strategies for actually effectively carrying out kind of protest that was allegedly planned for the Capitol. I watched everything. I just accidentally turned the TV on just to see what was happening on the count. I turned it on in Alaska, and so therefore I was there for about 12 hours watching everything. And I'm pretty confident just from watching them that that most of the people that went into the Capitol were as surprised as anybody else that they were in the Capitol, and they were acting like tourists. I mean, I watched them taking selfies and all kinds of stuff. Now, another batch of them were very destructive. And it's extremely important to understand that when a group of people are out expressing themselves, if you have leadership that is motivated in ways differently than the group itself, you can end up with the group going in a direction that the people in the group don't intend. So I'm saying that there is a lot of that participating in our situation here, and that's one of the reasons that we argue in the transpartisan review and the transpartisan movement that we have to have more than just left-right, more than just a continuum, more than just conservative-liberal. I mean, I'm looking right now, the conservatives are split 50-50, I don't know if it's 50-50, but split in two camps on pro and anti-Trump. The conservatives are split there. The liberals are split, you know, I would say the Republicans are split, and the Democrats are split on how harsh to be going from impeachment over all the way over to passing a law that Trump can't run for reelection, and further arguing that his money, all the money that he's raised in the last campaign, the $200 million, the thing since November 3rd, the $100 million or whatever, should be clawed back, and further, all of the losses that he's had in his businesses should be taken away. Now, there's a split on all of that on the left, you know, the Democratic left. So we're saying look at the four quadrants, and you can start to see kind of a framework of what's likely to happen. Now, Trump, if he can play his cards better than he did on this march to the Capitol, could be a long-term player. If he continues to muff things like he did on the march to the Capitol, he'll continuously minimize his effectiveness. My view of Trump over the years – go ahead.
And let me interrupt, Jim, because we're on a hard break on this one. It's going to shut us off in like 60 seconds. So go finish your thoughts.
Okay.
And then we're done.
Well, I was just going to say, my watching Trump in the White House, it seemed to me like a guy who went into thinking he was going to be playing golf or at best, at worst, football, but he was actually in a mixed martial arts match. And I frankly, as much as he's won tactical battles strategically over time, I don't think he's done very well. Now, you know, a lot of his supporters that I talk to are saying, yes, he's winning. These are all victories, and you'll see that in the long run he's going to be on top of everything and run things, and he'll be emerging as president on the 22nd of January. I mean, people are telling me that. I do not predict the future. I have no idea. I'm very interested in why people believe that, and I want to watch very, very carefully and see what happens, because it doesn't look to me like that's likely to happen, but then that, of course, depends on, you know, how well it's all played by both teams.
I agree. All right. Well, we've said 30 minutes. It's going to be a hard break on 30 minutes. Thanks for being here, Jim Turner. And drive safely wherever you're going, and we're going to catch everybody next time on Building Fortunes Radio. Thanks, everyone.
All righty. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks,
bye.
Jim.
You've been listening to the Citizens for Health radio show, brought to you by Citizens for Health on buildingfortunesradio.com with Jim Turner and Peter Mingles. Thanks for listening. For nearly two decades, Citizens for Health has been a nonprofit pioneer in the natural health freedom movement. Go to www.citizens.org to learn more and always listen in to Building Fortunes Radio, where our special host,